It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. For more than 100 years, World Affairs Councils of America have fostered shared experience and cross-cultural learning in offices in cities across the nation. And here in Pittsburgh, there's a new president and CEO at the helm. Betty Cruz brings 20 years of experience in community outreach and program management with enterprises like Change Agency and All for All. She spoke with The Confluence's Megan Harris.
Betty, congratulations on the new post and welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you so much. It's really great to be back.
What was it about the World Affairs Councils generally and our branch here in Pittsburgh specifically that made you want to be part of the team?
Yeah, it's just been an incredible coming together of building on my past experiences. So when I look at an organization like the World Affairs Council of Pittsburgh, that's been around for almost 90 years. So 2021 will be our 90th year anniversary, and it's focused on global education and really looking at both the work that's happening in schools as well as in the community. It really has been just a wonderful opportunity that builds on the experience that I've had over the past few years, getting to work with our international community, with our immigrants, with elected officials, with grassroots organizations, to think about what inclusion needs to look like in our community. And we've had the chance to do programming that's education-focused and really working to change the narrative in how we look at global engagement in our region. And the chance to do this now with the World Affairs Council just really builds on these different experiences I've had the benefit of being a part of.
So did you find the World Affairs Council? Did they find you? How did that come about?
Yeah, they found me. So I have been hard at work with the Immigrant Inclusion Initiative All for All that we've been working on for the last 3 years at Change Agency with a number of partners in the region. And I had trusted community partner who reached out to me and said, I knew that the opening was happening. I knew that the change was happening because we had partnered with the World Affairs Council in the past.
Your predecessor was there for about 4 years.
Angelica, yes. Angelica Ocampo. And she was there and she was active with our All for All work. And I received a phone call from a community leader who asked if I'd thought about it. And I said, quite honestly, no, I hadn't because while the World Affairs Council has this amazing legacy that I was familiar with, dating back to when I was a grad student at Pitt, I was familiar with their CEO at the time, Steve Sokol. I attended some of their programs, and I definitely knew about the work that they were doing. And I think part of why I hadn't thought about it is also what excites me about the change and the potential for what's to come. And why I'm also particularly energized by this experience, because everyone from the board to community partners, everyone is really excited about change. Like, we all recognize that there's this legacy here, that you're talking about an institution that's been around for almost 90 years. Even folks who don't attend the programming know peripherally, like, I've heard about this institution. I don't quite know who they are and what they do. And we want to change that, right? And that's part of what I'm looking to bring. So when the opportunity was brought to me, I said, well, it sounds great. Now, if I go in there, I want to shake things up. I want to make sure that people both like me and others who didn't even know that this organization exists, don't know that this organization exists, don't know what they do, don't feel that it's accessible for them, feel included and want to be a part of it.
Raising that exposure, is that the big part of this conversation, or is there more that you feel like the organization could be doing from the inside?
I mean, I think it starts with who's at the table, right? So I think it's not just about designing. It's never any organization should be about designing, should not be about designing programs or solutions for communities without them. So I think raising the exposure in terms of having representation from the communities that we know need to be present and aren't. And that means youth, that means people of different races and ethnicities and faiths and economic backgrounds. So yes, it starts with that exposure and that inclusion, and then not just having them at the table, but having them actively co-designing what the future looks like with us.
So it sounds like there's going to be a little bit of marketing, a little bit of a communication strategy, and maybe a little fundraising as well.
Absolutely.
Do you feel like you're in a good place to get started with all of that, you know, from day one?
So the road that got me here has been one where I was asked consistently what my vision is, right? And I've shared a vision, and I stand by that. But at the end of the day, what's most important, how you actually build and implement that. And what matters most is what does the community want? What do our partners want? Do they see themselves in that vision? So I'm absolutely ready. But the funny thing about ready, and everyone wants to maybe hear what the immediate action is. And one of our most immediate actions is to listen. And maybe that sounds a little passive for some folks, but really that listening part is going to be so important. So that's what my first 100 days really is going to be centered on, is that listening, talking to folks one-on-one, forming a transition team, hearing from them, having them be a sounding board, making sure they're representative, right, of the people that we're talking about that need to be at the table, and doing a lot of evaluating. We've been doing this work for a long time. We have so much really great wins to tout and to reflect on from the programming we've been doing in schools and, you know, reaching over 4,000 youth and all of this. And this is wonderful. But I'd love us to do a deeper dive and actually evaluate that work and understand what our wins are, what the gaps are, and what the possibilities are.
We're talking to Betty Cruz, the new president and CEO of the World Affairs Council in Pittsburgh. One of the goals of the World Affairs Council is to promote a better understanding of contemporary international issues. Do you feel like this is going to give you a bigger platform to do that, maybe?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that in Pittsburgh, we've had an opportunity to talk a lot about equity and inclusion. And I feel like that's a very relevant topic, whether we're talking about global affairs, whether we're talking about new neighbors, whether we're talking about decisions that are coming out of the administration currently, how to kind of break down these different silos that exist. We need to move from having conversations that are just an academic exercise or conversations that are deep but confined to the grassroots or community meetings, and really bridge them across so that both influencers and elected officials and people in positions of power, as well as community members who have power and voice and agency and should of their own, are brought together. So I absolutely think that the World Affairs Council has an important place to play as it relates to being a leader, a convener, a bridge across those groups, between those groups, to have these important conversations and move those conversations to action.
Betty, a lot of your previous work focused around children and teens. That's always been a primary focus of the council. Do you know yet how you'll bring young people into these conversations on the front end to help maybe dictate policy at some point in the future?
Yeah, so I think a lot of times there's really great work that's happening in Pittsburgh, and we've gotten better at being aware of our partners and who's in the space. I think we can get even better at collaborating, at seeing where we're working towards the same goal and how can we be even more effective, right? There's so much of this work to do. There's plenty to go around as it relates to making sure that we are preparing a global future workforce, a globally minded future workforce, that when we look at global education, we are not just talking about what's happening in the classroom, but how that is pulled into the community, both with youth, but also with adults across generations. So I think that the what's been lacking there is we have this great work that's happening with our global education program in schools. And then separately, we also have this great work that we've been doing around our public policy programs. I want to see a stronger bridge because the young people who participate in our programs, those are our greatest assets in many ways, right? So how do we bring them into our other programs, help them maybe design what they want to see in terms of who the future speakers are, who they, you know, where they want these meetings to happen as well. So I'd love to see our public programming move more into the community, into spaces that resonate for young folks, that resonate for folks from different backgrounds and interests, and see us really co-designing this work with youth and folks from different backgrounds is going to be key.
There's been a lot of educational efforts, a lot of exchanges led through the Global Affairs Council. Do you imagine bringing that more into the forefront? Will it go beyond, you know, the traditional student exchange program kind of mentality?
So I think that the strengthening of coordination, working with coalitions like ones that already exist, looking at our own work and how we can deepen our access and remove barriers so that Black kids, immigrant kids, and just youth from all different backgrounds that haven't known about these programs or just don't have the time or resources can be better equipped to access them.
How do you reach them? You know, whether it's across generations, races, cultures, faiths, ideologies, and as you said, economic backgrounds, how do you build that bigger table?
Yeah, so I think that we have to look at what are our offerings, right? How are they structured? So we have this great, robust public policy program series where we have speakers from around the world who are experts in their field who will come and talk about their topic of focus and where these conversations are happening. What do they cost? Are they showing a relevant thread to the Pittsburgher who's here? And again, let's go back to that point of insularity, who maybe isn't as connected to the rest of the world. And just in today's life as well, there's information overload, right? So it's, I think, no matter what city we live in, you want to be locally relevant. So it's important for, with each of the topics that we address, that we understand what the local relevance is. Why does this matter to the 13-year-old growing up in Homewood as much as it matters and it should matter to the 50-year-old in Sewickley, to the 30-year-old in Braddock? Like, we need to see the interconnectivity between these global issues to what is happening locally.
Is that intimidating or exciting?
Exciting. I think it's, I think we need more nonpartisan, fact-based conversations. It seems like an obvious thing, but it's been an interesting past few years where we're, as an entire society and world, talking past each other, and it's been overwhelming. And I think that they're for all of us as citizens of the world. And I think that I'm excited to be part of an organization that's really looking at the solutions of how we can move a conversation forward with our partners, with our community. And I think that Pittsburgh is well positioned to be a model, both, and I refer to the Pittsburgh region, to really be a model across this country of how we can bridge that divide, bringing people together from urban, rural, across different ages, across different backgrounds, on a conversation and issues that needs to be addressed, and we don't have time to waste.
Betty Cruz is the new president and CEO of the Pittsburgh World Affairs Council. Betty, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
The Confluence airs weekday mornings from 9 to 10, but the news never stops. Find stories, conversations, and full episodes on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
Drag culture has become a bit more mainstream over the last decade, but in 1993, RuPaul broke major ground with the song Supermodel, You Better Work. RuPaul made a big impact in New York City in the early 90s and even snagged a recording contract with the Tommy Boy label. He worked with composer Jimmy Harry and producer Larry T on the song, which tapped into America's fascination with supermodels. Supermodel became the first charting song from a drag queen when it entered the charts at number 91 on this day in 1993. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
Shell's ethane cracker in Beaver County could be just the first of many in our region. Activists are busy trying to build in environmental protections. This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapple. Like Shell, PTTGC America of Thailand would use ethane from the region's natural gas to make ethylene in the form of tiny plastic pellets at a plant 75 miles southwest of Pittsburgh. Many public officials, business people, and trade unions are looking forward to the thousands of construction jobs and hundreds of permanent jobs the company has said would come if the cracker is built. The company hasn't officially announced its plans. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant is here with me now to talk about how environmental activists are responding. Hey, Julie.
Hi, Kara.
Environmental groups were critical when Ohio's EPA approved PTTGC's air and water permits for the proposed plant back in 2018.
Yeah, three groups appealed to a state environmental commission, but then the company agreed to strengthen its leak detection and repair program and to publish all the environmental data it sends to the state, and then the groups dropped their appeal.
Well, you've reported about nurdles. Those are the tiny plastic bits produced at ethane crackers and their potential to wash into the Ohio River. Similar problems have happened in Texas, right?
Yeah, that's right. Researchers say they find nurdles on every beach they monitor along the Texas Gulf Coast. And last fall, a judge approved a $50 million settlement with Formosa Plastics for releasing millions of nurdles into Texas waterways. Activists in Ohio, like Cheryl Johncox of the Sierra Club, don't want that kind of plastic pollution here. But she says these materials are not specifically regulated.
It's not that the permit allows for it. It's that the Clean Water Act does not have a section that would restrict that discharge.
Regulators in Ohio and Pennsylvania say the water permits for these facilities already address nurdle pollution.
So activists are starting their own environmental testing project.
Right. Leatra Harper is head of the nonprofit Freshwater Accountability Project. Her group will be setting up monitors at places like schools and senior centers near the site of the proposed cracker to get a baseline of already existing pollution before the plant's built. And they're hoping to work alongside Ohio regulators.
We're opening the door to their air experts to work with them to provide our science and our measuring capability and our support system to collaborate on this. It would be really very unique, but I think it's very important to establish relationships like that.
In an email, the Ohio EPA said it will not be collecting this data, but it is connecting citizens with agency technical staff.
Okay, well, what's been the reaction from the company, PTTGC?
Let's hear from Dan Williamson. He's spokesman for the company talking about activist efforts.
We're in complete agreement with them that the air and the water and the health and the safety of the surrounding community absolutely must be protected.
Is this surprising, a company supporting these citizen-led efforts to monitor pollution from their proposed facility?
Well, that's what he said. He told me the Ohio River is a national treasure and that the company is committed to protecting it. Now, when it comes to plastic pollution, Williamson says PTTGC understands that there's a global trend toward banning single-use plastics. He says most of the company's business is supplying materials to make plastic products that are used more than once.
Okay, thanks, Julie.
Thanks, Kara.
The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant covers the Ohio River and lots of other topics for us. There's more at AlleghenyFront.org. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Kara Holsapple.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pennsylvania's 2019 Teacher of the Year, Joe Welch, says being vulnerable with students and finding ways to reframe historical lessons has served him well in his 13-year career. 90.5 WESA's Sarah Schneider brings us this story from his North Hills Middle School classroom.
Joe Welch asks his 8th grade American history class to select issues they want to change in America. They say gun control, immigration, climate change, and criminal justice.
You want to make these changes, what do you do about it? What can you do? You're in 8th grade.
Then he introduces an escape room style activity. Each group has to solve a series of puzzles about the Constitution to open a locked box.
Okay, that's big letters.
Oh, wow.
Bill.
Try that in the word lock.
It's a fun and engaging activity, but also breaks with traditional lecture-style lessons. And it's a style of teaching Welch says he's more comfortable with after many years of teaching. He says he can now confidently react on the fly and deviate from the lesson plan when necessary.
You never know what to expect that's going to come out of a 14-year-old kid's mouth on a daily basis. And just being able to roll with it, react with it, and then make it something productive out of it.
How has your teaching practice changed in 13 years? Because you teach social studies, which could be repetitive, right? You're trying to get through the same content year after year. So how do you try to stay relevant, especially as your students are evolving too, right? They're changing year to year.
We've been blessed recently to have some, and especially American history. I feel like there's been a renewed focus on American history. And part of that is the Hamilton effect of, okay, now let's go back and let's redefine how we're looking at history. And let's not just look at people as characters anymore that are stagnant. And I mean, we look at George Washington and he's this stoic presidential figure, but let's look at some of the other folks as well. And is this the real George Washington? And then second, and this could be a blessing or a curse, depending on how you look at it, just the current events that are occurring in our nation. There's so much that's going on, and I think it is a time where there really is a heightened awareness among not only Americans, but I think eighth graders as well.
And you talked about like reframing the narrative and stories that we tell, and personally I've been thinking a lot lately about what I learned when I was in school, and I feel like adulthood has been relearning a lot of mischaracterizations of stories. Are you reflecting on how you were taught too?
Absolutely. And the first day of school, I have students just draw. I say, you know, I want you to draw what you feel American history is. And this is an eye-opening experience, not only for me, but I think for the students, because I teach about 110 students this year. And I think the number was around 82, 83 students drew George Washington. And another 20 students drew Abraham Lincoln. And there were a couple military drawings, and two females were drawn, and two people of color were drawn. And that was it. And then I prompt students, I say, so what are you telling me American history is as far as what you've learned? And who are we leaving out of the narrative here? And I think that's the more important piece, because if we are defining American history as George Washington and Abraham Lincoln, of course they made some absolutely important contributions to our country and to our history, but there's so much more.
435.
During the escape room style lesson, one group of students successfully broke into the locked box. The treasure inside? Envelopes addressed to local lawmakers. Welch directs the students to write letters about the issues they want their state senators and representatives to prioritize. Welch likes to connect historical figures to today's legislative process because he says he wants his students to learn from the past and feel empowered and civically engaged. I'm Sarah Schneider, 90.5 WESA News.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The coronavirus disease, officially named COVID-19, has overwhelmed the Chinese health system for the past 6 weeks. Not one to stand by when a neighbor needs a hand, Pittsburgh-based Brothers Brother Foundation has mobilized aid, including 180,000 surgical masks to medical facilities across China. Joining us to talk about their efforts are President Azee Samad and Sarah Bowl, Assistant Vice President for Disaster Response and Strategic Initiatives. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks. A pleasure. Kevin, thank you so much for having us.
So the outbreak was first identified in December in what is now considered the epicenter of the crisis, the city of Wuhan. The U.S. declared it a public health emergency in late January. When did Brothers Brother get involved?
To be quite honest, we got involved right towards the end of January, and we have been involved ever since. And Sarah has been leading our efforts in this regard.
Wait, Sarah, what did those early efforts, in late January look like? Was it a matter of finding out who to contact in China to coordinate sending the relief materials?
So the first steps are really exactly that, to be able to find out exactly who is working on this and what partners we can pull together to try to make the effort as effective as possible, and to also assess what we have available to send.
What you have available. But what if the need for something specific isn't what's in the warehouse, if you would? How quickly can you respond to get those partners that you need that could donate those materials?
Well, we work with organizations like ourselves across the country, and so we have all been having regular communication to make sure that we can source those things from other organizations, and then also to reach out to other sources such as our hospital networks or purchasing groups, though that has been a little tricky on this.
Yeah, Kevin, we are fortunate to have relationships going back a number of years with various hospital networks and other organizations that have given us a number of supplies and equipment. So fortunately, we've reached out to them. There has been, as Sarah mentioned, this has been a more challenging situation just because of the overall demand out there. But we're working on trying to assess the situation and get more supplies in.
Yeah, you work with local groups on this, including government officials, volunteers, Chinese Association for Science and Technology, Pittsburgh.
What does that collaboration sort of look like? How does it come together?
So every situation is a little bit different, but in this case, the CASTP, Chinese Association for Science and Technology in Pittsburgh, have really been instrumental because we don't have any native Chinese speakers on our staff at Brothers Brother, and they have been really key in helping us to navigate through the consulate in New York and to translate all of the official documents and to work with the ground transportation for these items once they reach China.
For these items, mentioned surgical masks, any other items, resources are being sent?
We're looking at gowns also complete what would be considered like a hazmat suit. So that's something else that we're working to send. I just do want to add to what Sarah said in terms of the Chinese friends, I would say, that we've been working with to the extent that they've actually physically been in our office and they're working to put labels on pallets that are going on. So it's been a partnership that's really emotional, I would add, and they're extremely friendly and as, I would say, as helpful as they possibly could be. So it's a really warm relationship, and I do want to emphasize that.
Sarah, working with other groups that maybe already have some connections to China, does that sort of help pave the way for you to send that relief?
Absolutely. Never do we want to go into a situation like this without really understanding what the community needs, because we don't want to send things that create more of a mess on the ground. So those warm relationships really are instrumental in every one of these situations, and they know what their own customs regulations are, what the challenges will be on the ground.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We're talking with Ozzie Samad and Sarah Bull of Pittsburgh's Brothers Brother Foundation. You provide assistance all around the globe, responding to natural disasters, now an epidemic. How difficult is it to provide that aid in far-flung places?
Kevin, what we really rely on are partners on the ground. So what we found is for us to, first of all, maintain a low-cost structure and also be able to get the aid to those in need, that it's critical for us to have these partners on the ground who are usually from the country that we're working in and really have a network to be able to deliver. We've really had this, whether you're looking at a hurricane response in Puerto Rico or whether you're looking at even domestically in Houston after the hurricanes, or if you're looking at a country in, say, in Africa, if it's Malawi or if it's Ghana, it's really our partnerships that help us deliver the aid.
How do you make sure that the aid that you send actually gets into the hands of the people who truly need it? And how do you know from afar what need even means?
So we always ask questions. We start by saying, what do you need? What do you want? And then supplementing with, have you thought about this? And we won't ever send things that people aren't specifically requesting. And then we always follow up with our partners. So we got confirmation this morning from the Hubei Charity Federation that they had received our items from the airport and were distributing them. And so that was really key for us to know that things were getting exactly where they needed to go.
And that makes you feel good that your efforts are actually being successful.
Absolutely, Kevin.
Right. You're also working with the University of Pittsburgh's Asian Studies Center. Why'd you partner with them?
Because they reached out to us and asked for help.
They asked to help.
Yes. Well, and because they have specific regulations regarding education that they can only do certain things, but they wanted to be able to help their colleagues, and they needed a nonprofit to be able to facilitate that for them.
And the universities, Kevin, in general, have been absolutely superb in helping us work with different groups from various countries. So we do that with CMU. We do it with the University of Pittsburgh. So that's been an ongoing process in a number of different situations. Again, I'll bring up Puerto Rico again. We just had an email last night from a group wanting to work there. And the Chinese Student Association has been, you know, superb in that category. We actually are inviting them to come and volunteer also on our locations.
When you get that request to help, want to be part of it, and specifically the University of Pittsburgh's Asian Studies Center, have they changed or maybe refocused any original strategy you folks developed in this particular response?
In this particular response, we rapidly came up with a strategy, but it was really driven by the students and what they wanted to do. And so we haven't reformulated at all, but we are looking to make sure that we can make that the most impactful response that we can. And it's a student-to-student effort. So these items will, they're collecting items at Pitt that will be being sent to the University of Wuhan. It's right to their counterparts directly. It's a great program.
So this is not going to be, okay, a one-time shipment because this epidemic is not over and doesn't seem like it'll be over anytime soon.
No, we actually intend to continue our efforts. And furthermore, when we had our contact and from CAST, which Sarah mentioned earlier, we actually are having ongoing discussions about how we can work hopefully beyond this situation along with the people of China to help in various ways. So we really want to expand our relationship.
Brother's Brother has organized aid for disasters for 61 years, so it's probably safe to say you have ideas about how Pittsburghers can pitch in. For those listening, what do you need to continue doing this work?
We need you to visit our website at www.brothersbrother.org, where you can make a donation or learn more.
And we will have a link to more resources about getting that aid effort on our website, WESA.FM. Ozzy Samad is president of Brothers Brother Foundation. Sarah Bowles serves as its assistant vice president for disaster response. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The mass migration of Jewish immigrants to Pittsburgh began in the 1880s, well before the atrocities of World War II. A new exhibit at the Holocaust Center of Pittsburgh celebrates that local Jewish origin story and shares how their perseverance contributed to the spirit and vitality still found in city neighborhoods today. Executive Director Lauren Behrensfather joins us now. Lauren, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
The exhibit itself, mostly panels, some photos, lots of stories.
Yes.
What made you want to focus on this aspect of the Jewish experience?
Well, it's a longer story than this exhibit. So quickly, we were thinking a couple of years ago about an exhibit that showed the flight of Jewish refugees from Nazi Germany before the Holocaust and then survivors coming here afterward. After the shooting at the Tree of Life building, our lens shifted a little bit because we found that many people didn't know how deep the roots of the Jewish community in Pittsburgh go. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to take the opportunity then to tell a larger story.
Speaking of stories, is there an immigration story that you're especially excited to share?
One story that I love, which really is the culmination of the exhibit, so spoiler alert, I'll just share a little bit, is the story of Zina Saul, who was herself an immigrant from Poland near the Lithuanian border and became a really important advocate for immigrants and refugees in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, as you were doing your research, what through lines did you discover about why so many Jewish peoples came to Pittsburgh?
Well, the through line that we expected to see was the through line of discrimination and really danger to Jewish populations in Europe. And that is there. But there's also a through line of people coming here seeking opportunity. So within a story that is in many ways a story of being threatened and fleeing persecution, there's a story of hope and a story of what people were able to achieve in Pittsburgh.
Europe, what countries did they come from?
So in the earliest days, actually, there were German Jewish refugees. So that even predates 1880. And those were the first Jewish immigrants to come here. And there you see the establishment of synagogues like Rodef Shalom and the Tree of Life Synagogue, 1850 and 1860. But after that, you have a very large wave, 2 million immigrants coming from Eastern Europe, Russia, then from the Soviet Union. So that was the main wave, 2 million into this hemisphere and more than a million to the United States.
Was Pittsburgh their first home in America, or did they live for a while in another city and then relocate here?
Many people came straight here. There was opportunity here because of the industry.
Today we think of Squirrel Hill, but for many, that wasn't their first home in Pittsburgh, mostly Hill District, once they decided on Pittsburgh. Why so?
Most migrants to Pittsburgh settled in the Hill District, so that was true of Jews, and this is around 1900, turn of the 20th century. Jews, people who came from Italy and other countries in Europe, even the migration of African Americans from the South after the Civil War. So all of those populations lived in the Hill District. It was a very diverse community.
So was it that diversity or something else about the Hill District that sort of attracted newcomers to our region?
Some of it was economic. Mm-hmm. So migrants of more means lived in other parts of the city, but most of it was economic, and also it became known as these aid organizations formed, which is part of our exhibit, that that was a place where people could be integrated into the society. Immigrants from other countries could learn English there, mm-hmm. could find jobs there, that sort of thing.
Was it an easy journey? I mean, Ellis Island would have been open during part of that period, but that doesn't mean American immigration policy was especially receptive.
So it changed over the period of the exhibit, and that's part of the story, too, how immigration policy was adapted in part in response to this large wave of Jewish immigrants and immigrants from other parts of Europe.
So let me ask you this. Do you think that our ancestors, our forebears, found true opportunity in Pittsburgh, the inclusive, respectful society that they dreamed of when they headed our way?
So there's no denying the opportunities people found here, and that is absolutely part of the story. The movement of the population, you know, once they had established a foothold here, moving into other neighborhoods, the growth of Squirrel Hill, the growth of the community of Stanton Heights, which really was Jewish for one generation, and that's my mother's story, so it's very close to me. I had a grandfather who grew up in the Hill District, so for many people in the Jewish community, it is the story of our families. Of course, it was difficult to leave Europe. You had asked me that. Of course it was difficult. You left your family. You came often with no resources and into the unknown. Mm-hmm.
The Holocaust Center of Pittsburgh, of course, is free to the public, though donations are always welcome.
Yes.
Why is that accessibility so important to the mission of the center?
We feel really strongly that we are for everyone. We are for everyone in the city of Pittsburgh. So we don't want to put up any barriers to people coming, meeting us, seeing our displays, getting involved with us. We're inclusive and open and welcoming.
What do you hope people leave with when they see, when they experience this exhibit?
We always want people to leave our center with hope. We talk about some things that are, of course, very, very difficult. We're comfortable with difficult subjects, but we also find hope in many aspects of what we talk about. And that is really what we're hoping for. We're hoping we can have difficult conversations and people leave with optimism and with an awareness that there are things that they can do. If they don't like what's happening around them, there are things that they can do.
And it'll be open through?
We're having it through May, and that gives us time to add some of the artifacts in our collection that are in the exhibit now as scans of the documents. We will have some artifacts in place. We'll be adding some extra hours. We're open during the day, so we know that for some people, they can't leave their jobs to come and see the exhibit.
And very briefly, and it's important to get school groups to come visit.
We'll have two school groups at least each week coming between now and the end of the year, and we're excited that they're going to hear this story.
Laura Bairnsfather is the executive director of the Holocaust Center of Pittsburgh in Greenfield. The For You Were Strangers immigration exhibit is now open. Lauren, thanks so much for joining us today on The Confluence.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. If you missed anything from today's program, or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Caldwell Holden and Caroline Burke. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.